All right. It is February 28th. It is a Tuesday morning, and I am here in the Culpeper County Public Library once again with Jean Kane. It is a lovely day, and we're going to do the second half of this oral history interview. Yesterday, we talked a great deal about Jean's childhood, her college education, the kind of transition into graduate school with help from the teachers at Keuka and Mount Holyoke, and then her early work as a substitute teacher and then into RCA Laboratories. We also talked about her involvement in the Liquid Crystal Project, her hiatus due to maternity leave, her return back to RCA Laboratories on a part-time basis, and I believe that we left off shortly after the move back to Virginia. You were in Vienna, correct?
Right.
Okay. And there was a brief stint as a substitute teacher in there as well. And we were just about to start with your arrival at the U.S. Geological Survey. Now, before we get into that, I wanted to ask if there was anything else you wanted to add from our discussion from yesterday.
Just a bit. We spoke about the summer projects at Syracuse University, and yesterday I had not been able to remember the name of the second professor that I worked with. It was Bill Baker in the lab there at the university. And there was, we'd also talked about what experience I'd had with other women in chemistry departments, in laboratories, whatever. And I recall that Bill Baker had a PhD candidate working in his lab that summer. The only woman at that point that I knew who was young, newly married, that kind of thing. And she discovered during the course of that summer that she was pregnant. And it was major upset in terms of how do I go on from here. And again, because I was there for only 6 or 8 weeks, I have no idea how it worked out for her.
Right.
But it was a traumatic summer of being very depressed about her situation and how it was going to impact the plans she'd had.
And this kind of relates to the experience that you had at RCA,
correct?
At
RCA, yes.
You mentioned indeed. That there was some concern about whether or not you'd be able to balance out having a family.
And that was also even more a factor in terms of the way the Mount Holyoke faculty reacted to a wedding coming between the end of coursework and the defense of a thesis.
Right. Okay. So, with all of that said, I guess we should get right to the USGS. Now, take us back, if you will, to where we were when we left off yesterday. You had just left RCA.
I had left RCA. I had basically been gone from RCA at that point about 6 years. And in that hiatus, there was community volunteer work in two school systems, but there was nothing truly professional. A little bit of substitute teaching in the second school system in Freehold. But then when we moved to Vienna, the children were enough older that substitute teaching, again, was a perfect fit for doing something that would engage me during the day when they were not needing me at home, but that also provided some degree of stimulation for me of the sort that I was really missing. I not only did substitute teaching and primarily at the elementary school level, but I also was on the superintendent's parent advisory council, which met once a month and looked at all kinds of programmatic things that might be changed within the school system. So both of those avenues were very valuable at the time, but was also getting to be time to get back to chemistry if I was ever going to. And in the D.C. area, there's really very little industry. It's government or it's not, or it's academia. And at that point, I was reasonably sure that the instructorships that might have been possible 8 or 10 years earlier without a PhD and with the hiatus were not going to be even thinkable.
Right.
So we saw an advertisement, probably in the Washington Post, for an opening at USGS, and I applied. And I was hired then. They had a rather strange program called When Actually Employed, where you did not have benefits of any kind, you did not have vacation days, you did not have paid holidays, you got paid the days you were in the lab, period.
Right.
And it was done at the time, I think, primarily because Congress had put ceilings on the number of full-time positions within the government and then allocated those out across the different agencies. And the people who were hired, WAE, did not count toward those ceilings. So it was a way of circumventing and
right.
building up your staff. But at the time that I was hired, it was represented to me as, you haven't worked in 6 or 8 years, and we really don't know how good you're going to be. I mean, your references are all personal references as opposed to career-based references. And so this gives us a period of time in which to see whether you're really going to work out.
So it had kind of a twofold effect. On the one hand, it allowed them to get around government quotas and expand their staff. And on the other hand, it gave them sort of a provisional status that they could apply to people
right.
whom they weren't sure.
Weren't sure of. And so, you know, again, perhaps somewhat naive, but I took it all at everybody's word, and I was quite content. Again, was working part-time because the children were, I think, second grade and fourth grade when I started, so that working 5 days a week, but a 6-hour day, they could leave for school as I was leaving for work. They could get home
as you were getting
no
home
more than 10 or 15 minutes before I did. And so the after-school child care programs that exist today were unheard of then.
Right.
And it solved basically all of the issues of how this was going to work out for the family as well as for me.
Now, at this point, your husband was working for which firm?
He was working for the Department of
okay.
Energy.
He was
we had come to Washington when he had left Commonwealth Oil, when someone then at DOE in the new allocation program that had sprung up as a result of the oil embargo and all of the gas lines and that kind of thing. Someone who had known him from his time at Sun Oil and was familiar, knew that he understood the petroleum industry, which they were going to be regulating.
Right.
And so he was asked if he would be interested, and we definitely were.
Okay.
So we came to Washington then.
Okay, so the next question I have is, he had previous experience working kind of in the oil industry and doing chemical engineering work related to energy and petroleum products and so forth. You applied for this job at USGS with how much experience or knowledge about geochemistry?
Absolutely none.
But that did not stop you.
And it did not stop me. Again, I wanted to find something that fit where we were living, that fit the children's schedule as well as my interest. And flexibility is the name of the game in those situations.
Okay.
And again, as I think I said yesterday, to my mind, the most important thing about education is that you learn how to learn. And I love the challenge of going into something totally new and different and learning. So I was borrowing geochemistry textbooks from every geologist whose samples I analyzed. I was using the library extensively. I was reading voraciously, not only geochemistry, but also when I was hired at USGS, it was in the branch of analytical laboratories. So we were a service function, but we were also strictly chemical analysts.
Mm.
And the chemical analysis I did at USGS was a world apart from what quantitative analysis in college had prepared me for. By the 60s, instrumental analysis rather than gravimetric had pretty much taken over the world. There was still some classical gravimetric analysis being done, but not much. And once you got involved with EPA, you were not really concerned about what the major constituents were. You were concerned with the trace elements that would become pollutants in the environment.
Right.
So I was doing atomic absorption spectrometry initially. As time went on, atomic absorption is fundamentally a single element technique. And of course, as everyone is looking for improved efficiency and greater throughput, what they want is a multi-element technique rather than a single element technique.
Could you clarify the distinction between the two?
The distinction between the two is that with a multi-element technique, a single measurement would give me data that can be applied to a dozen or two dozen or three dozen constituents in that sample.
Okay, so you might have a sample that has, I don't know, a dozen elements in it, and a multi-element approach would allow you to get maybe
all
half a dozen or
once.
All of them.
All of them at once. And again, I say all of them, but in some cases, a suite of them as
right.
opposed to all of them, because for most of the instrumental techniques that I used, the inductively coupled plasma optical emission after the atomic absorption, and certainly for the newer ICP mass spec that comes even much later and that I've never specifically used. There are spectral interferences when you're trying to get several elements in a sample that hasn't been separated out. There are not only spectral interferences, but physical matrix effects that might suppress the absorption or the emission of the line you're trying to look at, so that at first a great deal of chemical separation was involved in isolating the one element that you're particularly interested in, or the two or three.
Right.
And again, as the methodology changed so dramatically over the time I was involved, the separations went from being single element separations to being multi-element separations. So there was this tremendous transition. If you go back to the 30s and 40s, obviously well before I was involved, geochemistry was primarily a matter of X-ray diffraction to identify specific minerals in a rock, having basically crushed the rock and then doing heavy liquid separations where you're isolating them by their density. You use different solvents, you float some part of a rock away and collect another fraction that's heavier.
This is the gravimetric analysis.
This is actually the mineralogy analysis, which is the gravimetric would have looked at silica, aluminum, iron, the major oxides that make up the rock, and would have been a quantitative measurement of how much of each of those elements was in the rock. The mineralogical says, is the iron hematite, or is the iron tied up in pyrite? And there are hundreds of minerals that can make up a rock. So that, I mean, I've only mentioned a few, and heaven help me if I had to make, you know, I mean, there's feldspars, and there's calcite, and there's any number of other things, but aluminosilicates and micas and what have you. But the mineralogical is a totally separate type of analysis from the gravimetric, how much silica, how much alumina, how much iron, how much calcium, how much magnesium. Those were things like a precipitation or a colorimetric, having separated.
So the separation is with the mineralogical technique you were describing, which is with different liquids and densities.
And densities, and you're collecting different weight fractions because each mineral has its own specific density.
Right.
And
then once you've done that, you can start doing these other techniques.
Well, and in some cases, you don't do both. In some cases, you would only do the, you know, A Labs would only do the chemistry.
Right.
It was a different group within the geologic division that would have done the point counting and the minerals, heavy mineral separations. And you could also do what was called a thin section, where you slice the rock into millimeter or centimeter thick wafers and polish, and then look at it under a microscope and in polarized light. And,
right.
And all of those techniques were a group outside of the branch of analytical laboratories. But BAL would have begun with the classic gravimetric analyses. And then they moved to different instrumental techniques. For the major oxides, it was X-ray fluorescence.
Okay.
That was the primary technique.
And how did that work?
You irradiate a sample with... You're looking at X-rays that are emitted from a sample.
Okay.
Depending on the type of stimulation, you can either have atomic emission, you can have X-ray emission from a sample, you can have different pieces of the energy spectrum are examined with different spectrometric techniques, and X-ray is one of the ones that I really never used. But the different techniques were ideally suited to different suites of elements.
Right.
Optical emission probably covered the largest suite of elements, and it was one of the first to be developed, but it was stimulating the sample with a DC arc and then collecting the emitted, you're exciting the atom. And as the atom returns to ground state, it emits the specific wavelengths that had been
right.
stimulated. And that was a multi-element technique, and it was one of the very, very first that could be applied to trace elements rather than major oxides, although it could also be applied to the major oxides. But because of the calibration difficulties for that technique, and because of the difficulty of getting, well, depending on the matrix of the sample, the excitation from a unified arc might give you 80% excitation in one matrix of the element you were interested in, but in another matrix, only 70%. So you did not have a truly quantitative technique. You had something infinitely better than had ever existed before.
Right.
But for a variety of reasons, the method in general was reported as a plus or minus 20% method.
That's a pretty large margin.
That's a pretty large margin, but when a gravimetric technique or any of the classical colorimetric, titrometric really could not be applied below a tenth of a percent.
So for these sorts of trace
elements... So for any trace elements, they were utterly unusable, and a 20% number
was
compared
than,
to nothing right. at all is a dramatic improvement, and it led to all kinds of advances in geochemistry.
So you just listed several terms that I want to make sure I understand before we move forward, and
okay.
I also have a question about how you learned all of these techniques. So to begin with, just to be super clear, gravimetric, is that referring, that's density-based or no?
No, gravimetric is like a barium sulfate precipitation, and you then collect the precipitate and weigh it.
Okay, so it's weight-based.
It's a weight-based, you separate the element from everything else in the sample, you collect.
Right.
Whether it's calcium oxide or calcium, you know, and then you're obviously going to be drying the sample to constant weight
sure.
and that kind of thing. But it's a strictly weight-based technique that is tricky to apply because pretty much any step you might take to try to precipitate something or develop a colorimetric variation on it, there can be other elements that you don't want to get that react with the reagent.
Right.
And that then contribute to the weight or the color development or whatever.
Sure.
And it is nominally an exceedingly exact technique, but as we get into the standard rocks and that kind of thing, we will find out that the results when they did the first interlaboratory comparison where everyone was supposedly analyzing the same sample, but getting different results was described by one author as a bombshell.
Interesting.
In terms of how wide the disparities were between laboratories.
Hence
who
the
were
need
all
for very
theoretically
consistent.
Totally competent. They supposedly selected expert labs.
Hence the need for a well-defined standard and processes to get...
And the processes to get the standards.
And we'll get to those.
We will get there. But basically, you know, I started doing atomic absorption analyses and doing all of the different sample preparations that would get the sample ready, because what you do with both atomic absorption and atomic emission, not DCR atomic emission, but ICP atomic emission.
ICP is
inductively coupled plasma.
Okay.
You are aspirating a solution up into a flame. And you are then excited. The flame causes the excitation of the atoms.
And then when the ground state, when it returns to the ground state, that's when it either emits the spectrum.
Well.
Or in the case of absorption spectrum.
In the case of absorption spectrum, you are measuring absorption by shining a single wavelength light through the flame, and you are measuring the degree to which the sample absorbs
that,
part of
right.
that light. Whereas with emission, you're exciting the sample in the plasma or in the DC arc.
Right.
And then you are measuring the emission from that excited sample
okay.
as it returns to the ground state. But you have to direct a single wavelength of light through that flame and sample for the atomic emission process.
Now, for the source of that light, was that typically
it was
like
a hollow cathode lamp and electrodeless discharge lamp? There are different elements behaved differently in terms of whether you could use a hollow cathode lamp or whether you needed a different process to generate that wavelength of light.
Okay. So another couple of terms that you threw out before, I know that you're very excited about the various
That's
forms
fine.
Of spectrometry, but I just want to make sure that a couple of terms get clarified. Titrometric, is that just titration
That's
type analysis?
That's just a titration type analysis.
All right. And for colorimetric analyses, I mean, I assume it's based on color. Were there standardized color charts, or were
well,
you...
Well, yeah, you've got a UV visible spectrometer. You have your sample in a cell, like a test tube. And again, you are then measuring the intensity of the color that has developed at a specific wavelength. Different reagents, molybdenum blue, for instance, is one of the easiest ones for me to think of. But there are, silica could be done by a colorimetric technique. I believe alumina could be as well, but I'm not sure. I never did the colorimetric on those. I did the moly. But what you are measuring is the intensity of the color development at a specific wavelength.
Right.
The reagent you add to the sample reacts with molybdenum or whatever. In the tungsten was the other colorimetric technique. I never mastered it. I could never do that analysis. Whatever the color forming process was, it was very easily with the tungsten disrupted. And I always lost the color before I could get the measurements made. So other people did. The only analysis I tried to learn to do that I never succeeded with.
Was the tungsten-based.
Was the tungsten-based colorimetric. But you can also do ion exchange separation to remove the bulk of the matrix. You can do any number of other kinds of things, and they all had their place in the lab. There were probably 15 or 20 of us when I first started. Well, there may even have been more, because there was an X-ray group. There was a neutron activation group, and then there was the optical emission and absorption group that I worked with. And I'm not at no less than 20 of us at the laboratory in Reston. Then we also had other laboratories in Menlo Park, California, and in Denver, Colorado. They were all part of the USGS Geologic Division.
Okay. This gets nicely into a question I had about overall organization, as well as your kind of introduction to this new environment. So the 15 to 20 people you were describing were all working at the BAL?
At the BAL in Reston.
In Reston, which was one of several labs.
One of three laboratories.
That were under the auspices of the USGS.
Yeah, but you've got, USGS had several divisions. There was a coal branch, well, the coal branch would have been in the geologic division. There was a geologic division, there was a water resources division, there was a division of exploration research, maybe exploration again was in the geologic division. There was a mapping division. You know the old geological survey maps.
Right.
That was a huge part of USGS.
Certainly.
There was a technical reports unit.
Now, where were you in this?
Where was I in this? I was in Reston in the branch of analytical laboratories in the atomic spectroscopy as opposed to X-ray or neutron activation group.
And the branch of analytical laboratories was in the geological section?
Was in the geological division.
Okay. So, you were in the optical emission group.
Right.
How many people were in that group?
More than 10. Part of the difficulty is that there were major reorganizations during the time I was there when everything was shrinking.
Okay.
But Fred and Paul and me and Anne and Esma and Marion and Joe and Herb. I would say there were 10 of us in my group, and then there was at least, and then there was the X-ray group and the neutron activation group as well.
Okay. So within that group, when you first arrived, were you assigned to work with someone in particular, or were you set out on your own?
No, basically... the group leader, my supervisor gave me a great deal of instruction. Another geologist, geochemist in the group, also very much. And then the group was such that there was a lot of interchange, and you might be paired with this person for learning this analysis, with
right.
that person for learning the next one. But there was a great deal of collegiality and sharing and cross-training and working together that I never felt abandoned to teach myself
right.
in any way at all.
So who was your group leader when you arrived?
Fred Simon.
All right. And how would you compare Fred Simon to John Van Ralty as a supervisor, or more generally, the USGS to RCA Labs as a place to work?
I think part of it is just my different, it being a different place in my life.
Right.
Fred was, the whole climate at RCA, I felt like was part of a much larger group than I had felt a part of at RCA.
Oh, so at USGS you
at
felt
USGS,
like you were...
I felt there was just, that I had interactions with many more people. And also because it was chemistry rather than electrical engineering, I also had a totally different knowledge level. Even though geochemistry is different from chemistry,
right.
And instrumental analysis is different from the gravimetric, titrometric kinds of things I had experienced in college, there was still a much more common ground.
Right.
That made a totally different feeling in terms of how well I fit in and that kind of thing. John and I worked so much more closely together, and in reality, Dave Kleitman would have been my supervisor.
Right.
So there was a much more direct contact with Fred over all the years I was at the labs
compared to
with the contact with Dave, and there were more colleagues to associate with on a regular basis where I felt like I knew what I was doing with them.
Right.
At USGS.
The organizational structure, it sounds like, from what you were telling me yesterday at RCA, was relatively diffuse or difficult to pin down?
Difficult to pin down, or again, I just, you know, didn't take the, you know, I had so much else to learn,
right,
that I wasn't paying attention to it.
But it sounds like here, by which I mean at USGS, it was a little bit more clear cut.
It was both more clear cut, and it was on paper and spelled out,
right,
almost from day one.
Okay.
So that, you know, they were more concerned with making sure everyone knew where they fit and what,
right,
the structure was.
Now, you mentioned that this was a whole lot of new material being thrown at you very quickly, and not just material, but also techniques. You also alluded just a moment ago to people who would help you learn some of these different instruments and analytical tools that you would be approaching. Mm. Could you comment a little bit or give a specific example or two of someone who helped walk you through the process of learning one of these techniques and how that sort of relationship evolved over time? How did you, like, for example, first learn how to do you know, atomic absorption spectroscopy or what have you, or spectrometry, sorry.
Well, basically, you know, the very first lab assignment, you had written procedures in the first place, and in the second place, the very first time you were doing something, you were doing it in someone else's lab with them kind of watching over your shoulder the whole way. And who was doing it varied considerably. I mean, there were several in the group: Phil Ariscavage, Esma Campbell, Marion Schnepfe. There were others who were almost as new as I was. But there was, and Fred and Paul Greenland were involved as well, so that you were shown. And there was always someone to talk to as you were doing it. And yet the techniques, those techniques, for the most part, were rather straightforward and easy to learn. And I don't recall there having been any real difficulty.
Okay. By that point, were there standardized instruments, or were you basically...
Oh, yeah. The first ICP, optical emission, was not a commercial instrument, but all of the atomic absorption instruments I used were commercial. And as I think about it, the flame atomic emission was definitely there right from the beginning. I don't remember whether the graphite furnace atomic absorption, not emission, whether the graphite furnace atomic absorption was there when I first started working, or whether it was newly introduced very shortly afterwards. But that let you lower detection limits, but it forced you to do chemical separation. With the flame, you fundamentally had no need to separate the element you were looking for out of the total dissolved rock solution. But with graphite furnace, because the atomization process was so different, you were pipetting 20 microliter volumes into a graphite tube that was then heated to 2700 degrees, which was about 1,000 degrees hotter than the flame would have been.
Right.
So you get a different degree of atomization. And the reason you wanted to do that was to get both the refractory elements, which can't be done in the flame at all, and some of the lower concentration elements where there's so little of it that the sensitivity of the instrument wouldn't let you detect them in a flame. But the atomization process in the furnace had so many matrix interferences with it that you had to have separated it out first. And cadmium diffeson extraction is the first one that I used routinely in the way of the graphite furnace. There were some later that we did not do separations, and that was mostly the refractories, the molybdenum, vanadium, things of that sort, that were so refractory you couldn't atomize them in a flame.
Okay.
And also were such low-level trace elements that you couldn't detect them in a flame even if you'd been able to atomize them. The sensitivity was just altogether different for the two forms of atomization.
Huh. All right. So it sounds like you had a great deal of support as you were going through, learning all of these different techniques. It also, based on the list of people that you mentioned, sounded like there was a bit of a closer gender balance. Would that be accurate? Were there more women working?
There were many more women. One of them was a PhD. How do I say it? All of us were in a service division. So all of us were doing day-to-day analyses of samples to give other people the information they needed for their research rather than doing a great deal of research ourselves,
right,
on the one hand. And on the other hand, because as all of these new instrumental techniques were being introduced and the possibility of expanding the element list beyond the majors or beyond the minors, major being over 1% and minor being between 0.1% and 1%, and then as the new techniques came in, you could get down into... By now, you can get down to part per billion, part per trillion. You couldn't initially. So all of that was creating a demand for new methods.
Right.
And so the research within the branch of analytical laboratories was about developing the method that would let you measure an element that you couldn't measure last year.
Right.
Or to go from being able to measure it very accurately at 100 ppm to being able to measure it equally accurately at 100 parts per billion. And so within the branch, there was a fair amount of method development of that sort. Most people stuck with doing the routine analyses and turning out an analytical report for the geologists.
Right.
Some of us did the other, did the method development research.
And that was one thing in which you were interested.
And that was one thing in which, you know, I just took off and flew with. And even the ones who did the research and co-published, I mean, most of the method development work was two or three people working together and one perhaps being the leader in it, and the others, again, being the hands that did all of the analysis as the method was being developed. I did both halves of it.
Right.
But some of the women who got co-authorships on the method development papers probably did only the not the real thought of how do I, you know, what is the chemistry that I'm going to apply, but you got your name on the paper because you did the analysis.
Right.
In the number of replicates that would both demonstrate that the method worked, but also then provide the data on the existing collection of standard rocks that USGS had so that other people then had a quality control material. I probably half the women did as I did, but others really did, you know, were the technical support behind the method development rather than directly involved in the literature search and the thought process and the let's try this and but would apply the method to the standard rock data set after the method had been pretty much blocked out.
So another question I had about this new environment was whether or not you encountered the same degree of chauvinism.
A little bit, but not as much. Both at USGS, less at USGS than at NIST, but there was some degree to which the PhDs on staff had far more flexibility about doing research, far less responsibility for carrying a part of the analytical support work.
Right.
And there was one situation in terms of a personnel action where Fred was trying to be very, very helpful. I had gone in as a chemist, and he initiated a personnel action to reclassify me as a research chemist, which should not have been the slightest problem.
What's the distinction there?
The distinction is how far you are likely to go up the promotion ladder, how many opportunities you are going to be given for some time away from the routine service work.
So this was an attempt to help you.
So this was an attempt to help me climb the ladder. But because he initiated the action without my knowledge, when I found out, I blew my stack. I mean, I thought it was the kind of thing I should have been asked.
Right.
We were also in the process of trying to make the switch from WAE to permanent employment. And I didn't know which piece he was doing.
Right.
And I went nuts. It's one of the few times I have ever truly gotten into a shouting match with the supervisor.
And what was the outcome?
Well, the outcome was that I found out what was going on because I went into the personnel department wanting to see my record, and they couldn't show it to me because we were working on it. And I said, what are you working on? Why are you working on it? What are the problems? and they wouldn't tell me. And, you know, and I got really huffy about, it's my personnel record. Why can't I see it? And, of course, that left Fred feeling terribly embarrassed and put upon for having tried to do something nice that I was throwing a tantrum about. But, you know, that was the one time when I felt like Big Daddy was taking care of me instead of letting me be a mature adult.
Right.
And take care of, you know, I could have initiated that action. I could have gone to him and said, I would like to be transferred to this other career path.
Sure.
I hadn't. I was trying to get a permanent position instead of a WAE position, and what helped enormously there was that throughout government, and I have no idea how much of USGS rather than other parts of government were totally abusing the WAE, because it was supposed to be a temporary position. Not a permanent one, but some people had been in it for 8 and 10 and 12 years. And
right.
Becomes an issue. And so Congress was pulling the plug on their ability to use it for more than a certain number of months, and all of that kind of thing.
I see.
Certainly helped me. But I didn't know what was going on. And I really felt that as an adult, whose career was going to be affected by whatever it was, whether positively or negatively. So I was a bit of a problem for Fred that day.
So what ended up happening?
Well, what ended up happening was, one, I got the research chemistry categorization. Two, I got a permanent position.
Okay.
And not only permanent, but sometime fairly soon thereafter, realized that part-time wasn't going to work any longer. But, you know, by then I'd been there long enough. The kids were 6th and 8th grade rather than 2nd and 4th. And so I felt like I could be gone more of the day without doing them any serious harm.
So this was around 1980 or so?
Yeah, probably.
Okay. And did your relationship with Fred?
We had one major blow up, and other than that, there were no issues.
Okay.
Eventually, and I can't place exactly when, we also had a branch of international geology. And at some point, he transferred to that. But other things were happening simultaneously, or not quite so, you know, again, I can't exactly place. But the branch of analytical laboratories and the branch of exploration geochemistry, at some point during my time there, were merged.
Okay.
Branch of exploration geochemistry, BGC, was only in Denver, and A-Labs had been at the three sites. And so now, instead of having the branch chief in Reston, which had been headquarters, and so when we were branch of analytical laboratories, the branch chief was located where we were. Once we merged with GX, the branch chief was in Denver because the exploration geochemistry branch was larger than BAL, even though it was all in one place. So the branch chief was located out there, and my supervisor then was out there as well, at some point. I think Fred moved to the international division, and Dan Golightly became the supervisor of the atomic and spectrometry, the AA and the optical emission. And at that point, he was developing a non-commercial inductively coupled plasma instrument with Akbar Montasser at GW University in D.C. And the two of them were collaborating very, very extensively. They also had a gentleman from GMU, James Madison University.
Over G in, or J?
I think it's J. GW is George Washington University in D.C.
Right.
That's Montasser. Then it's James Madison University that's in Harrisonburg, Virginia,
okay.
I believe. And that's where I think it's Jim Leary or Jim O'Leary. He came out summers when the university was not active and worked with Akbar and Dan on simplex optimization for the ICP.
Now, when you say that this instrument was inductively coupled, what does that mean exactly?
All right. What you've got is a radio frequency coil surrounding the flame of helium gas that's at the tip of the torch, and it's the radio induction that triggers the sparking and the flaming of the helium gas. So you've got a glass torch through which the helium is injected, and at the top you've got a radio frequency coil. Well, within the torch, you've got a radio frequency coil, and then above the torch, that coil will have basically causing an explosion of the gas, and it's this ball of fire much hotter than anything in an AA flame, even when you go to the nitrous oxide flame or you go to the furnace atomization. It's really hot.
Okay.
And again, you're aspirating a solution, and it's in this flame, and then because of the temperature, you get a totally different degree of atomization, ionization, and then excitation of both the atoms and the ions, because you have emission lines from both in this plasma. So you've got a much more complicated spectrum than you had with DC arc.
Right.
And you're, again, multi-element because it's emission rather than absorption, and you don't have to have a single line from the hollow cathode lamp. Now, of course, when I was doing the work on the multi-element atomic absorption, that's another story. But there you were using a deuterium arc continuum source rather than a single line hollow cathode lamp.
So it sounds like you got very heavily involved in the technical side of this sort of instrument design and testing process.
Not so much the design, but the testing and using and making sure that it would give you accurate results.
Right. So, you know, figuring out if everything was in the right place, making sure that everything was in the right position, tweaking and adjusting things as necessary.
Things as necessary.
These were all things that if you had told me about it yesterday when you were, you know, describing, for example, your master's research,
a totally different world.
Well, this is what I'm kind of
interested in. A completely different world, and a world in which truly I was less comfortable. I was involved in all of it, but I was not the lead person. I could never have been the lead person. It was almost like the difference on that instrumental development stuff where I was more the technician giving them support and less the lead researcher. I was more dependent on other people than independent. You know, I could design an extraction process that would separate cadmium from that rock solution that had everything under the sun that was in the rock in it.
Right.
I could do that totally independently.
Okay.
I could not have done these other things with anything like the same degree. I could be part of a team.
Right.
But I could not be a solo player.
Okay. So let's start going through some of these projects and try to pin down not only when they happened, but who else was involved and where you fit, if that makes any sense.
Okay.
So all of these instrumentation techniques that you just mentioned, were these from the outset, like when you arrived at USGS, you were already involved in the inductively coupled plasma project?
No, the inductively coupled plasma project didn't even begin until a few years after I was there.
Now, was that after your original boss transferred, or?
I honestly don't remember.
Okay, so let me see if I can ask it in a different way that will hopefully make it a little more easy for you to remember and for us to make sense.
Pull the.
So this is your bibliography. List of your bibliography.
Then I can get some dates out of the co-authored papers in terms of when we did what.
So while you're looking through that, I'm going to try asking another question, which is what your first assignment was when you arrived.
The very first assignment was in Fred's group, and I was doing exclusively atomic absorption work.
Okay. And then...
And then as time went on within that atomic absorption work, I was doing different types of sample prep, like the cadmium extraction, like the bismuth extraction that is probably my very first paper at USGS, because I got there in 76.
Right.
And in 79, the bismuth method development paper for atomic absorption spectrometry with electrothermal atomization, again, that little graphite tube as opposed to, was 79. So my guess was we had the flame instrument for sure, and not just the first one that they'd ever had either. It had probably been around for 8 or 10 years.
By the flame instrument, you mean the graphite furnace?
No, I mean the graphite furnace is heated graphite atomizer, HGAAA, as opposed to flame AA.
Okay.
So the flame was either aerosetylene or nitrous oxide, depending on the temperature flame you were trying to achieve. And they were there, and that technique probably first commercial instrument, if I remember correctly, was roughly 1960.
Okay.
So it would have been there and in use for a reasonable length of time before I got there. The graphite furnace was a newer development, and while it may have been there when I first arrived, it may also have come in
around the same time.
But that did require the chemical separation of elements. And so 1979, is the publication date, which means I probably did the work in 78.
Right. And this was stuff like, that was the bismuth?
Right. Bismuth extraction for graphite furnace atomic absorption.
Okay. So you started off with atomic absorption work. You moved on to sample prep, the bismuth extraction process. You mentioned another one, I think, as well.
Cadmium.
Right.
done for coal, and that I'm not sure I developed that rather than I used it very extensively.
Okay. So after doing sample prep, what next?
Well,
or I know there was probably some overlap.
The sample prep was a part of doing, you know, whoever did the atomic absorption analysis prepared the samples for it.
Okay.
So, I mean, I was doing the sample prep from day one.
All right.
And as well as...
But your main analytical technique, once you had done the sample prep, at that point was atomic absorption. And this was both flame and then later heated graphite. Okay. So... I guess my next question is, at some point you switched from doing just atomic absorption work to other forms of analysis?
Other forms of analysis. And again, some of it was simultaneous with.
Of course.
Because there were some elements that simply couldn't be done by atomic absorption. And so the colorimetric molybdenum and tungsten and things of that sort were... You know, you take a week out of atomic absorption and you do a number of these samples. But
that actually begs another quick question, if I may, which is how long it would take to run a sample. Like, what would that involve?
Okay. Totally a function of what you're trying to do. The extractions were done in sets of 18. And when I say sets of 18, two of those might have been control samples, two of them calibration standards, and 14 of them actual samples for the geologist. But in terms of the typical flame, whether AA or whether later the, I say flame, but in the inductively coupled plasma, which is similar to a flame, but not quite the same. We would prepare batches of 40 samples, and even with the cadmium extraction, the typical job from a geologist had 40 samples in it.
Okay.
And I could set 40 up on the hot plate to do the decomposition.
Right.
And I would get them weighed out of an afternoon. They would sit on the hot plate all night. They would be evaporated to dryness when I came back in the morning.
Okay.
I would take up the residue in acid, make it up to volume, and then I would take the samples to the instrument.
Okay.
And on a day that I had done the prep, and so had to spend the first hour or two of the morning getting things made up to volume and out of the beakers and that kind of thing, I could probably do three elements of the seven that I needed to do on the flame atomic absorption instrument in what was left of that day. They move fairly quickly.
Okay.
You're aspirating something into the instrument, but it only needs 2 or 3 seconds in the flame to be stable enough to get a good reading.
Right.
You record the reading and you move the aspirating straw into a rinse solute in water.
Okay.
Put the next sample in 30 seconds later. I mean, literally as fast as you can move them back and forth. And by the time I left, they had automated sample changers on all of the instruments, which we did not have when I started.
Well, this was one question I had, is exactly how much the machine did the work, right?
The machine does all of the work, in essence. I mean, what you are doing is you're preparing the sample. Your job is to get the sample to the point that it can be introduced to the machine.
Right.
To record the machine reading.
So you had to pick the timing when the moment when you wanted to record the reading? Or did it record it? I mean, it seems like it might record it automatically.
It records it automatically, but you know, there's some degree of instrument noise, and if I remember, and I may not be remembering correctly, that you know, like so many things, an automatic reading will pop up every tenth of a second or right. every second or whatever.
So you had to wait for it to stabilize.
You wait for it to stabilize, and then you write the reading down, and you might go back and run through the entire sample set twice rather than just once. And so you've got two readings, and then you would go to a calculator and you would do a least squares fit of the absorption readings for your calibration standards. And then you would back calculate then every one of the absorbance readings for your samples from right. that calibration curve.
Okay.
And as time went on, more and more of that became automated. But initially, you were doing, you know, there were no sample changes.
Right.
Initially,
you were the sample changer.
There was no computer printout recording the readings.
Right. You had to mark
you
that down
to
yourself.
You had to do that yourself.
Okay.
So that changed fairly dramatically over time.
Okay. So to do a typical test might take, in total, it sounds like, you said a day or so, maybe half a day to do the sample prep initially, leave it overnight, get it ready, and then with the remainder of the day, so
that
maybe
could, you know, it,
maybe over the course of two work days?
A couple of work days. I mean, again, depending on what the samples were, what the job request was, coal samples were the first thing I worked on extensively. Okay. And the coal analysis was cadmium, which was the extraction. So 40 samples was 3 days of extractions.
Wow.
Okay, because again, I mean, the extraction process, you're adding reagents, you've got separatory funnels, you've got an airflow with a straw bubbling all of them so you don't have to shake them and so that they can be done fairly automatically. That extraction, we took the cadmium diphison complex into xylene. And then you drain the aqueous out, threw it away, washed the xylene layer twice, and then back extracted into hydrochloric acid. So there were several steps in the process. But you could run all of, you could run the samples and probably then go to the graphite furnace and read the 18 I extracted this morning before I went home at the end of the day. But
right.
still, to do all of the samples in that 40-sample job was probably a three-day process. The decomposition was half a day, and again, you'd start at the end of one day and use an hour or two, and an hour or two in the morning of the next day. And then there were seven more elements to be read on the flame. And two of those elements needed matrix modifications, so you had to do a dilution because they were minor elements rather than trace elements, and AA is really a trace element technique.
Okay.
So you're beyond the calibration range of the instrument unless you dilute. And in diluting, you're also adding a matrix modifier, which was lanthanum something. Because with the alkali metals and alkaline earths, you've got a different degree of tendency to ionize instead of staying in the atomic form, and for atomic absorption you want only the atom being
right, no
generated
ions.
In the, you prefer no ions, so the matrix modification suppressed ionization and that let you do those two. But I could read 40 samples for three or four elements in a single day.
Okay.
Once the solution was prepared. So a 40-sample coal job for the eight elements that I was determining was typically a week's work.
Okay.
Now, I say typically a week's work. I also noticed fairly quickly that I worked at a different pace than most people worked at. Other people might need 2 weeks.
I see.
It was rather interesting in that, you know, something like 6 months after I got there, I said to Fred one day, well, how am I doing? You know, it wasn't time for a performance evaluation, but again, there were all these rumblings about not from Fred, not from Irving May, who was branch chief at the time and did the hiring, but from some of the staff about, you know, these WAE people, are they really worth it? And these,
right,
you know, and these people have taken 6 years out. Do they really care? And so I asked him, how am I doing? And he said, okay, no problem. But he didn't say anything more than that. 9 months later, when the year-round summary of everything the branch had done came out, and I looked at the fact that I had the shortest work week, the lowest pay, the highest sample throughput of anybody in the lab. And again, that's only half the story, because if someone was doing nothing but extractions, were doing none of the quick flame stuff,
right,
that, you know, it's a totally different story. But nevertheless, it was rather telling that I was doing okay, but nothing more said.
Right.
And yet when I looked at the report, it was holy Toledo.
So you were more than holding your own.
It's more than holding my own.
All right. So with that slight diversion about the actual hands-on aspects of the process.
Yes, indeed.
So you were doing sample prep for atomic absorption spectrometry early on.
Right.
How did you get more involved in developing or refining these newer techniques? The plasma emission one is the one that comes to mind, but it's not the only one, correct?
Yeah. It was rather interesting, and I don't remember which came first or whether they were happening simultaneously in terms of the multi-element atomic absorption work
and the plasma.
But so I was involved in both of those as instrumental techniques. Jim Harnley was a PhD candidate initially and then, you know, a postdoc working at the University of Maryland, working with Tom O'Haver, who was University of Maryland. That's where he had gotten his degree, but just, you know, 2 miles down the road from University of Maryland is the U.S. Department of Agriculture's research facility. So Jim was at USDA, perhaps while he was working on his degree, definitely as a postdoc, but he was looking for a permanent appointment, and he wasn't getting anywhere. So he applied to USGS, and Dan Gallightly hired him and basically said, Gene, I want you to work with Jim on getting this instrument, finishing the development of this instrument and making it a part of what we're doing. And I was thrilled with the opportunity. Just getting the appointment at USGS meant that USDA, who hadn't been able to move on a permanent appointment, could.
Right.
And did.
Okay.
And so he never came to USGS at all. He had been hired, he'd been offered the job and hired, but he never actually came on board. Because just that stimulated
right,
USDA
that was enough pressure
to do what Jim had wanted in the first place. And so I spent a couple of years, it's hard to remember how many, going back and forth every Friday from Virginia to Beltsville to the research station and working in Jim's lab with him on this instrument. And either Nancy was already there as a PhD candidate under Tom O'Haver when I first arrived, or she came in very soon thereafter.
Nancy
Miller Ely.
Okay.
Again, one of the first direct acquaintances with, other than Marion Schnepfe at USGS, with a female PhD or PhD candidate. And so the three of us spent a couple of years working quite extensively.
This is you and Jim and Nancy.
Jim and Nancy working together quite extensively on, all right, the fundamental theory is that flame conditions, measurement height in the flame, all of these things in atomic absorption are fairly element specific.
Okay.
And so we were doing an optimization study. Two millimeters into the flame, into the blue, into the yellow, into the orange. A number of different studies in terms of how sensitive is it?
Right.
And to my mind, if I'm getting 99% of true value at one set of flame conditions and 100% in another and 101, but all of those are plus or minus 3%, there is no difference.
Okay.
So we did a lot of that kind of work that basically refuted a lot of what had been thought to be the case about multi-element atomic absorption would never work because you needed different conditions for every element, and indeed you didn't. We were using instead of the standard atomic absorption instrument, it was in a shell grating instrument, and we had 16 photomultiplier tubes behind various slits. I mean, again, it's not as multi-element as emission.
Right.
You can't do 32 or 4, you know. Just the geometry was such that a bank of 16 PMTs was about the best you could do. But the elements they chose at USDA and the elements that we chose at USGS when we started duplicating the instrument were totally different because I was interested only in the trace elements in a rock,
right,
in a geologic sample, and they had some of the elements that I would have considered majors or minors that were critically important nutritionally.
So
that they had to have on their cassettes. So we were looking at slightly different element suites, and I would have to go back to both of our original papers to figure out exactly what the differences were.
But so you could adjust the instruments, depending on the position of these photomultiplier tubes, to pinpoint different elements?
Different elements. And you designed the instrument.
Right.
For the elements you wanted.
And the other difference you mentioned was that in a typical AA setup, you would have a different light source.
You would have to change the hollow cathode lamp as you went from measuring copper to measuring lead to measuring
right.
zinc. You would put a different lamp in position.
Right.
But with the multi-element, you're using a continuum source deuterium arc lamp.
Okay.
So you now have everything And in terms of the way your cassette is set up, in terms of the slits that you've chosen, you're selecting out 16 very specific wavelengths.
Along this continuum.
Along this continuum.
Okay. Now, as you... It was really you, Jim, and Nancy who were working on this device.
Right. Tom O'Haver was Jim's and Nancy's thesis advisor, and obviously he was a major consultant in the process.
Certainly. So my question is, what roles did each of you play in the course of this development?
It was Jim's instrument.
So he really did the kind of engineering.
He and Tom had done all of the engineering.
Okay.
And had set the instrument up.
Okay.
We were using the instrument to do these optimization studies to say, yes, it really does, to demonstrate the effectiveness of the instrument.
Okay.
To prove that accurate analyses could be had in this way.
All right. Excellent. Okay. So you work on that.
Excuse me a minute. I've got a kink in the back of my leg. And
all right.
If I walk around while I talk.
No, that's fine. So while you're walking around getting the kink out of your leg, let me ask you another question. You mentioned that there was a transfer of this instrument from USDA to USGS.
No, we built a new one.
You built a whole new one?
We built a whole new one at USGS.
Okay.
And again, Jim was very much the coach, very much involved in it, but I built it.
So you built it?
Yes, I built it.
Okay, this is interesting to me because as far as I know, even though you were getting better through all of your experience at doing the actual hands-on work involved with this equipment, you have never come across in our previous discussions of your research as someone who built a lot of complicated instruments.
Well, when I say I built it, we assembled pieces.
Okay.
I mean, I could buy in a Shell spectrometer from Spectrometrics.
Okay.
I could buy the graphite furnace or the flame unit for atomic absorption from PerkinElmer.
Right.
I could buy the computer that did all the controlling from DEC.
Okay.
So that it wasn't building it in quite the same sense that the guy who, in the very first instance...
Right.
Figured out in a Shell spectrometer as opposed to a different kind of grating.
Sure.
It was assembling components and getting them put together in a way that would allow us to have a full system.
But that still requires a level of kind of hands-on tinkering ability.
It does.
Which I assume you developed through trial and error?
Well, in some senses, the machine shop at USGS and other people helped me with a great deal of that.
Okay.
There was...
I mean, this is just a very different kind of work
I didn't even like to have to change the torch in the ICP spectrometer.
Mm.
Didn't like to have to assemble the 16 PMT tubes in the shell.
Right.
I did those things. I had to do those things.
Sure.
But they were not the kinds of things I felt comfortable doing rather than felt stretched in.
Did you teach yourself to do those things or did you get assistance?
For the most part, I mean, Jim could uncover the different pieces of his instrument and basically show me
right.
what it looked like fully assembled.
Okay.
And from that, I could
okay.
go and do it. But, I mean, so when I say I built the instrument, it really wasn't as complicated as some building jobs might be.
Okay. No, I was just curious.
But it was still challenging. It was still, you know, it was still the area where this isn't what I do well. This isn't what I like doing. But it's also, it had to be done, and I could ask for help, but I couldn't be totally dependent.
Right.
So
Well, it also was a chance for you to kind of, to stretch your comfort zone a little bit.
Exactly. And it's always a good thing to do.
All right. So that gets sort of into the details of how this new multi-element instrument was introduced to USGS.
Right.
So let's talk a little bit about the other instrument that you worked on, the inductively coupled plasma. How did you get involved with that project?
Well, again, it was the same group within the branch of analytical laboratories that did optical emission spectrometry and atomic absorption, because they're both atom ion as opposed to X-ray or nucleus.
Okay.
And again, because I was one of the only ones who was publishing regularly and who was interested in doing something more than just the routine day-to-day stuff.
Right.
The opportunity was offered and I grabbed it.
Okay, who offered you the opportunity?
Well, that was Dan Golightly was the project leader at that point. Fred was no longer.
And this was internal to USGS.
This was internal to USGS.
Okay.
And
so you described already sort of what the instrument looked like, the inductively coupled, when you were telling me about the torch and the coils and what have you.
Right.
Were you also involved in a similar way in the construction of the instrument, like you were with...
No, again, that instrument, by the time we had that instrument, and I was involved, it was a commercial instrument.
Okay.
All of the, you know, the original prototype that Dan and Akbar worked on,
right,
I had not been involved in at all.
Okay.
But this was after we were introducing a commercial instrument, and we're going to be training then most of the optical emission staff to use it on a regular basis.
Okay.
That we were developing the protocol and doing the spectral interference investigations and things of that sort.
Okay. So your role in that project was basically similar to a piece of your role in the other, which is making sure that the instrument could be running tests to make sure that the instrument could be used in a way that would be productive
for the service function of the group. And also, you know, one of the things I did was to take what had been several fairly tedious colorimetric or graphite furnace methods, because beryllium was another thing that we did extractions on all of the time. Beryllium, tungsten, and molybdenum were all extractions. The moly and tungsten were colorimetric. The beryllium was graphite furnace AA. Tin was graphite furnace AA. That was another extraction. So we had these four extractions, and then lithium was a flame atomic absorption element. And once we had the ICP, you could do the five of them simultaneously and you could eliminate all of the extractions. And so it was a major efficiency step to find the, you know, and again, you know, it stood to reason that you could do this, but until you'd run a number of the reference samples
right. That
were already in existence and had demonstrated that you could get correct results for them and this, that, and the other. So I did a lot of that kind of thing. There was another project on which I did a different suite of trace metals that, again, had previously been done by atomic absorption, one element at a time, and moved to doing several of them at once on the ICP and documenting that, yes, we haven't degraded the accuracy. We can give people what they need, but it's a quicker process. It's much less.
You've introduced a new level of efficiency.
Yes.
Okay. One thing I didn't ask about during this, I guess I should have, was to try to pin down timing a little bit. Because this is all during the phase that you marked out on your professional history is between 76 and 88.
Right.
So the two instrument projects that we've discussed here, the multi-element and the plasma, are those both happening simultaneously? Did one come before the other? Are they happening like early 80s, mid-80s?
Okay.
To the publication list.
Publication list. The first, good grief, the first meeting paper on the work with Jim Harnley was September 1981.
So that's pretty.
So I would guess 81, early 80, late 80, early 81, Jim and I started working together. And we continued publishing together through 84 or 85.
Okay.
And then the USGS instrument showed up.
This is the USGS multi-element.
Multi-element. The USGS multi-element. All right, 88, 89. So the publications would have come out, you know, with a 6 to 12 month time lag from. So I would say that was like 85 through 88.
Okay.
Was working on the USGS instrument.
Okay.
And that was reminds me of the fact that that was one of the more awkward moments at USGS. Multi-element AA was something that was eminently possible, but because it came in pretty much simultaneously with ICP,
right,
and because instrument companies were not interested in developing both, it was going to be either or. It very quickly became apparent that multi-element AA was going to die.
It was never going to catch on.
It was never going to catch on. Partly because even with the multi-element capacity, you had a 16-element limitation, whereas you did not with the ICP. Partly because, you know, as I say, instrument manufacturers just were not going to go in two directions at once. So once that became apparent, USGS lost total interest in supporting further development of that instrument and that capacity for the laboratory. It would be too much a research novelty and never become a routine everyday something. So, literally overnight, and not even face-to-face, by letter, because my supervisor at that point with the merger of the two branches was in Denver.
This was your previous, the same supervisor?
No, Dan was in Reston, and so the merger must have come. And I was working with Dan through the early, so the merger must have come somewhere in the 86
okay.
kind of time frame, approximately. And so I was simply told I was going to have to shut the instrument down and go work for somebody who was a very highly reputable geochemist, but he was also not a people person at all. And everyone who had previously worked for him, as they came up for promotion, it's, well, because they work, because the, all of their publications are joint with X, we are assuming X did all the thought work and that this person shouldn't get a promotion. And so, again, I just drew a few very hard lines in the sand and I said, you're not going to do that to me. You can take the instrument away from me. You can say it's never going to go. But give me 6 more months with it to finish the documentation, the publications that are started, and find something else for me to do.
Right.
This other assignment just has no appeal to me at all.
You didn't see that as a kind of path to any form of advancement?
I saw it as a downward slope.
Okay.
And I got away with it. I made an awful lot of people very angry. I got the people at USDA and Tom O'Haver at Maryland to write to our chief geologist and to complain about the interruption of the collaborative process.
Right.
And did a few other things that really you know, everybody wanted this to happen without a paper trail.
You made sure there was a
paper
trail.
And I made sure there was a paper trail. And again, as I think about it, was it because I was a woman? I don't, you know, I don't want to go there. I know in the industry how many men have been terminated on 2 weeks' notice.
Right.
So I wasn't going to read it that way.
Well, you weren't going to be full out terminated here, but
no, but I was going to be put in a position where I saw it as a total dead end. Now it may not have been.
You mean collaborating with this
with this other person.
Who would get, it seems, more of the credit.
At least within USGS. I mean, he had a very fine collaboration over time after I said no with a PhD candidate, female, at the University of Maryland.
Okay.
But again, because they weren't in the same organization, because her thesis advisor was elsewhere,
you right. know,
the whole dynamic would have been very different.
Whereas if you were in the same institution.
Whereas if we were in the same institution and with the people who had previously been turning others down for promotion because they were his hands rather than the ones really putting the thought into the work.
Right.
And so that was, you know, that was another time when I rocked the boat a little harder than people liked,
but it
I rocked the boat.
So at this point, were you still officially part-time or were you doing this?
No, I was full-time before I even started on the multi-element work with Jim. The transition from part-time to full-time probably happened somewhere in the first 2 to 3 years.
Okay, and then you were there.
And then I was there
as a
full-fledged research chemist because both things
right.
happened.
So that was one question I had. Another question, which we've been alluding to this publication list, and I hardly have asked about it, was about research documentation policies and publication. Now, we talked a little yesterday about notebook use at RCA. Did they have a similar sort of notebook policy at USGS?
Yes, they did. And again, how carefully anyone else followed it, I don't know. I think when I left, there were about 20 of my lab notebooks. What became more and more difficult was that over time, so many things were on computer printouts that just could not be fitted into the notebook any way, shape, or form, and it's what do you do then?
Were you expected to turn these things into your supervisor, or were you just expected to hold on to
No, there was a long bookshelf in my office that just had a line of numbered notebooks. And I have no idea what happened to them when I left.
You turned them in then?
I left them on the bookshelf.
Oh.
I had a couple that I considered kind of my own private thought process and literature survey type stuff that I carried home with me, but anything that was laboratory data for the samples I had analyzed. What got turned in was a job report on each batch of samples that you analyzed. And that got turned in and eventually through a quality control process got reviewed and this, that, and the other, and developing a set of documentation on all the standard rocks that had been run with your batch of samples to confirm the accuracy of your data and things like that.
Right.
So there was quite a bit there.
You didn't have to turn in any sort of, equivalent to the private company report we were talking about yesterday, right?
There were open file reports that were used very frequently, much more extensively in the exploration geochemistry branch than in A-Labs, but every open file report counted as a publication.
Right.
So if all you were doing was service work, but you put every single lab report into an open file, as opposed to just a lab report that was turned over to the geologist, you could build quite a publication list. Now, I don't think I did more than a couple of open file reports myself. I did one when we had two or three, I don't remember, Egyptian Geological Survey chemists came and brought 100 or more samples with them and were trained in our laboratory on how we did our analyses as a prelude to buying their first atomic absorption instrument and things of that sort. And we definitely did an open file report on their sample results. I did an open file report documenting the construction of our multi-element AA system. I did an open file report years before that when I wrote a statistical program for the analysis of variance that was part of the bismuth paper and some of the other papers I did. They always wanted an analysis of variance for between bottle differences in standard rocks to prove the sample homogeneity. And this had been done, you know, on hand calculators and longhand and that kind of thing forever.
Right.
And I wrote a Fortran program the first year or two that I was there. And I probably didn't even put that one on the list. But I had mentioned yesterday contacting Tom Zajac when I first went to USGS for my thesis programming so that I would have a refresher course, and that was what it was used for. Now, by today, there are statistical packages by the hundreds that you can buy to do these calculations for you.
Sure.
But at the time, this was 1976 or 7, those programs weren't yet commercially available. And during analysis of variance by hand is quite a chore. So I wrote the program.
So did you have access then to your own computer in your lab, or did you have to share?
No. There, you know, back then, it was an IBM computer up on the seventh floor.
And, okay.
You know, again, punching cards and
right.
going up and feeding them in and all of that kind of thing. I did not even have a PC of my own when I first took over the Standard Rock program in 1988 or 7 or whenever it was that Frank Flanagan, I bought one at home and started out that way.
More broadly, you had access to AA equipment in your lab.
Right.
And also the multi-element that you built.
Right.
And possibly a plasma one as well?
Yeah, I also used the plasma one extensively. Now, we all had a chemistry lab for the sample prep.
Right.
But you don't want any of the acid fumes anywhere near the instruments.
Okay.
So the instruments were in common use
spaces
where I might use the ICP on Tuesday and Friday mornings and somebody else would be using them on Monday and Wednesday afternoons or whatever. I mean,
so it wasn't like everyone had their own set of instruments.
Everyone did not have their own instrument at all.
Okay. I figured they were expensive and you only wanted to
have... Yeah, there were common instruments that we basically, you know, as we were all working on our samples, we'd kind of keep touch with which day do you need the instrument,
right.
which day can I use it, and
okay.
plan our work around that kind of thing. I think by the time I moved over to the Standard Rocks, there were probably 3 flame units, 2 or 3 graphite furnace units. There was never more than 1 ICP in Reston. There was clearly others in Denver and in California. But, you know, and there was 1 LECO sulfur analyzer, for instance, and there was 1 specific ion electrode set up for the fluorine analyses we were doing. And there were, you know, and 1 LECO sulfur analyzer, because there were some things that couldn't be done on any of these other instruments
right.
that we had to do.
Okay. So one other thing that I was curious about, getting back to the publishing question, was about publishing what it looks like were some of your first independent peer-reviewed papers.
Yes.
How did that process surprise you? What did you expect going into it? Because you had written at RCA, I think you've listed 1 paper that was a collaborative paper.
It was a collaborative paper, and it was the only paper. At USGS, there were several aspects of the publication situation that, because I basically developed the bismuth method and did the hands-on part,
right.
it was a single-authored paper. It would have been a multi-authored paper if I had developed it and then one of the other chemists had done most of the handwork. It would have been co-authored. The one paper of that, well, there were several of that type at USGS that were collaboratively authored. Tony Dorsop was the group leader on the ICP at one point. I was doing most of the ICP work on massive sulfides from the Straits of Juan de Fuca. And at GeoExpo 86 in Vancouver, I believe, we jointly offered a paper that was both a meeting presentation and then a symposium volume manuscript describing the details of those two techniques and how they fit together and were used in the laboratory for geochemical analysis. I mentioned having done a lot of AA tin extraction work. And tin, if it's cassiterite, won't dissolve. If it's tin incorporated in the silicate lattice, no problem, and that's fairly routine in terms of low-level tin, but as the concentration goes higher, it's either in a tin sulfide or it's in a cassiterite. The sulfide dissolves, no problem. The cassiterite is a bear. And in many cases, a geologist would ask for some elements that could be done by both X-ray and AA or X-ray and ICP to be done by both techniques. Again, as a cross-check, is the data any good? And if there are discrepancies, why are there discrepancies? Is it that one of the analysts fell down on the job? Is it that the mineralogy of the sample has interfered in some way with a technique that normally works? Right. I will never forget the time a geologist with whom I'd had a really long, comfortable working relationship, and I was doing the mineralization indicator elements, lithium, beryllium, tin. other people were doing the moly and the tungsten. Beryllium normally is incorporated in the silicate lattice and is below 10 parts per million. But it can occur as the mineral beryl, in which case, you know, it's 90% of what's there. And he had a sample that was 5% beryl that he put in with his regular batch of samples without giving me a heads up.
Right. That must have been a little awkward.
I got something like a percent, but that was a very small part of what was there. But it contaminated the lab for months in terms of being able to do any of his low-level stuff.
Right.
And you're looking for 10 parts per billion in your graphite furnace injection, and it's going off scale even after you've delivered diluted it 1,000-fold. It's like, what have you done to me? But a lot of times the geologists would put the analyst on as a co-author when they were doing a paper about their interpretation of the data. But
right.
that wasn't routine. It wasn't normal.
Okay.
But that's where a lot of the NIST or the USGS co-authorships for anyone in the laboratories would come from.
I see.
Is that kind of a collaboration. I had very few of those. And again, because I did my own chemistry as well as the design of the procedure, a lot of what I did was single-authored, with the exception, of course, of the development work that I did with Jim Harnley and Nancy on the multi-element, or with Dan Golightly and Akbar Mantasser on the ICP as it was getting started.
Now, did you run into any trouble during the peer review process, typically, or did you find that to be
relatively
smooth?
Typically, I found the peer review process no big deal. Occasionally, there were truly obnoxious reviews in the way of just tearing something to shreds. But for the most part, there were no major issues. There were two or three experiences over time where someone was able to be very critical, but to do so in a way that left you saying, wow, you've given me the chance to take what was a B minus paper and turn it into an A plus paper, because you took the time to read it carefully enough and put the critique thoughtfully enough that it didn't leave me feeling so put down and so angry that I wanted to just throw the paper away and not bother. And for the most part, reviewers are anonymous in terms of the journals that I was submitting to, so you didn't know who to say thank you to.
Right.
The one case where that didn't, you know, where I knew exactly who had said the perfect thing, Jim Harley and I, in one of the early development stages, had gotten to a point where Jim said, let's get it written up. And I had said, we really ought to do one more thing to make this really perfect. And Jim said, I don't think so. And it was his lab, and I was not going to argue with him. But for the internal, at USGS, there was both an internal review process of your peers within the lab before you could even submit to a journal, and then an external review process. So I asked Jim if he'd mind having Tom O'Haver be one of the internal reviewers. And he said, no, that's fine. And at the sentence where we said, we could have gone one step further, but didn't. Letters this big, underlined, exclamation points. Tom just wrote, too bad. I showed that page to Jim. I didn't say a word. He said, can you come tomorrow?
So you added that in.
And we added that in the review process. Another time that I thought was absolutely outstanding, again, really taking a good paper and making it truly superb, was an invited paper, Phil Potts at the Open University in 93. So I was at NIST by this time. And I had done kind of a historical review of the development of a number of techniques in geochemistry. And the reviewer, you know, at first glance, it was highly critical. And yet when I started working with the comments, oh, I can change this paragraph and I can change that paragraph, and I don't really need to do more than add two sentences here and three sentences there. And when I was done, I felt like, wow.
Right.
You know, this is so much better than what I had done. And yet it obviously took someone who was both incredibly familiar with what I was trying to do and very, very willing to take the time to be constructive.
Sure.
And so I sent the paper back to the editor of the journal with a note. I know the reviewer is anonymous, but please, please convey my thanks. And got back from the editor. Well, the reviewer had asked to see it again, and he told me to convey to you his thanks for having taken it so seriously.
Wow.
And so it was just one of those. There are not that many instances in a career that it just feels so right and so supported, but that was one of them.
So I have one other question, and that's about conferences. You mentioned that you had gone to Geo Expo and a few other places, I assume, by that point. Those were your first experiences going to professional conferences, or had you been going to ACS conferences or other?
I even got to a few ACS conferences, but the conferences I enjoyed the most are the geoanalysis conferences, because there's somewhere between 100 and 200 people. They're small conferences. The Canadian Mineral Analyst Conference that I was invited to speak at was probably even smaller than that. But again, because in the non-conference time, there's so much nicer sociability with people that have very, very common interests. I always found the ACS conferences, I went to a few actually while I was at RCA, or at least one while I was at RCA, and I went to a couple in Denver after that. They're just so huge. The one in New York City where, you know, you're looking at 10 parallel sessions, and there's a 10 o'clock paper that you'd like to hear, and there's a 10:30 paper you'd like to hear, but they're 2 miles apart, and there's just no way to get from one conference room to another.
Right.
Whereas at the smaller conferences, there's never any of those issues. So I always enjoyed them far more. Geo Expo, I don't know how big that was. It opened with a field trip to some mines, and it was my first field experience as opposed to in the lab experience with geology. So I really enjoyed that. MARM meeting must have been Middle Atlantic Regional Meeting of ACS.
Okay.
That was one of the very first meeting papers I ever gave. Went to a lot of the FACS meetings, Federation of Analytical and Atomic Spectroscopy Societies, something like that.
Okay.
Analytical Chemistry and Spectroscopy Societies. I was actually an officer for a few years at the national level in FACS, or in Society for Applied Spectroscopy. So that was one of the Analytical Chemistry and Spectroscopy Societies that co-sponsored the FACS meetings. Those were smaller than ACS meetings, but still much, much larger than the geoanalysis types. And then at NIST, it was absolutely mandatory that you went to PITCOM.
Right.
Hated it, but I had to go.
Fair enough. Were there a lot of other women at these conferences? Did you make an effort to seek out other female
chemists? There were certainly more women than I had encountered, say, at RCA or at Syracuse University or UMass.
Sure. And did you notice a change over time would be my next question, right? Like there...
Certainly.
Okay.
Dramatic change over time in the number of women who were giving the papers.
Right.
And who were session chairs and who had... I mean, even at USGS, once we merged Branch of Analytical Laboratories and Branch of Geochemistry, there was a female branch chief for a short period of time. And I believe there is currently a woman who is branch chief. Ruth, and again, why names go right straight out of my head, I don't know. The one while I was there was Lori Filipek. I don't think she was there more than 2 or 3 years in the chief's position, but and don't know truly what changed, you know, whether it was one of those positions that simply rotated on a regular basis or whether she went on to something totally different outside of USGS or quite what terminated her time as branch chief.
Okay. Well, I'm looking over my list of questions to see if I've forgotten anything before we, it looks like it's almost 12:30, so we may want to take a break for lunch.
Good idea.
We talked about previous exposure to geological research. You talked to an extent about the difference between industry and government research. Did you find that you ultimately preferred being in the government setting than in industry, or that they were just different?
They were just different. I don't think, you know, I could say there was a preference for one over the other. The focus was different, and clearly at RCA, the research was not revolving around providing service to other scientists. It had a totally different purpose.
Right.
But I don't think that interfered in any way with the pleasure I took in the research. I don't think that distinction mattered.
Sure. Okay, I think that answers most of the questions I had about that period between 76 and 88. We're going to take a lunch break, and then when we get back, we're going to be talking about the Geochemical Reference Sample Program. Then I guess your switch over to NIST to work at the Standard Reference Materials Program,
mm-hmm.
and then a little bit about your time post-NIST,
okay.
which you've told me previously is some of the more exciting stuff that's happened in your career,
yes,
at least recently. So I'm going to stop the recorder now,
right.
and we'll come back in a bit.